From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Music, the greatest good that mortals know, and all of heaven we have below. So wrote Joseph Addison, the 18th century man of letters. But agreement about Addison's couplet among 20th century audiences might prove problematic. What is the status of classical music in the 1980s? If there is a canon of classical music, where does it come from, and who determines its contemporary outlines? Soundings put those questions to two music historians from the University of California at Santa Barbara, Edward Applebaum and William Prizer. Edward Applebaum is the winner of the 1984 Kennedy Center Friedheim Award, which has been described by one critic as the only significant competition in existence for new American music. William Prizer recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming book about Italian Renaissance music. Next week's edition of Soundings will feature a performance of Edward Applebaum's Kennedy Center Friedheim Award-winning composition. Ed Applebaum, let's begin our conversation about classical music in the 1980s. Tell me, is there a canon of modern music? Who figures out what is the canon? What goes into it? Who makes the decisions about that?
I think that the main decision makers today are the conductors. If we're talking about orchestral music, mainly the conductors, and to a ever so slightly less extent, ever so slightly less, would be the music directors of the various orchestras. The conductors are, by and large, the main shapers of what's going to be heard, as well as the shapers of how it's heard. And as long as the conductor, him or herself, is feels comfortable with and is interested in contemporary music, then there's going to be a lot heard. I think there's a basic misconception about that. That there's a financial aspect to all of this. In other words, that an orchestra or a conductor who performs a great deal of contemporary music is somehow going to be in economic jeopardy. I think the facts and figures are in direct contradiction to that. That the orchestras with the most adventuresome programming are by and large the ones who are doing better.
Question for Bill Prizer, following up what Ed Applebaum has said, would you characterize the conductors as historians of music? My question is, how do they develop a sense of tradition or contemporary elements in music so that they make the right decisions about what to play and what, as it were, to put into the canon, to put into circulation?
It seems to me that up until fairly recently, that conductors could be characterized more as museum curators than as historians. They were the people charged with keeping this vast mausoleum of music from about 1730 through 1900. And that was what made up the meat and potatoes of all orchestral programs of, of the major orchestras. One of the things that seems to me the most healthy in contemporary concerts nowadays is, in fact, the conductor's increasing willingness and effort, in fact, to find new pieces that are being done on the programs.
What would you say, a question for both of you, Bill Prizer at Applebaum, would you say that there is a tension merely in the fact that composers who are alive today feel kind of the weight of the past? Are there resentments there? How do they connect with the musical tradition so that aside from simply saying to themselves, well, I'm going to rebel, I'm going to set out on a new track here. Maybe you could speak personally, Ed Applebaum, in your compositions.
Well, before I do that, I'd like to answer the question because I like the question very much. There's a there was in the mid-60s to say mid-70s a kind of a school, I don't know, that's not really the best way to phrase it, there was a genre of compositions which did a lot of quoting of earlier music.
You mean sort of patchiness? When you say quoting, tell me about
actually,
that.
Well, actually, using music from earlier pieces. Uh-huh. Lucas Foss's Baroque Variations is one of the earliest pieces I know that does that sort of thing. George Rochberg and quite a few Americans have done that sort of thing, in which within the framework of your own composition comes entire themes or even movements of other compositions. Another example of that is the Berio Symphonia, in which he pretty much literally uses the scherzo from Mahler's Resurrection Symphony and superimposes quotations from other works from Beethoven through Stravinsky, all the while using the Swingle Singers as soloists in that piece.
All right, now let's pause on this for a moment. To what end, and how was this received? What do you as a composer think of that? How did the critics look at it? How did the audiences respond? I'm asking you to elaborate on, I don't know if we're trivializing here, but on one moment in which the past meets the present in terms of music history.
I can only give you what I think is a highly personal view of that mm-hmm. issue. I think, though, that there was a time during that period when composers were beginning to perhaps reconnect with the past, but I don't think that it was quite that conscious. Perhaps another way of saying it is to redefine their own position in the present uh-huh. with a feeling for an acknowledgement of, and perhaps a glance backwards and smilingly forwards,
uh-huh.
So it's simultaneously.
It's principally a harmonious relationship.
Most definitely so. Uh-huh. I think another new ingenious reconnection with the audience is occurring under the rubric of the New Romanticism.
Ed Applebaum, let's pause on that for a moment. The New Romanticism. Tell me about that.
It's a kind of a term which helps to explain a lot of phenomena which are otherwise unexplainable in a sense, and I think that's okay uh-huh. as long as we all understand what we're talking about. But I've heard several definitions of it. One being it's the return of the soft qualities of music. Another that it's composers once again daring to write beautiful music. Mm-hmm. Or maybe a third way of saying it is the composer's reconnection with his or herself through trying to express things to an audience.
Mm-hmm. Now, by contrast to what? Soft music, beautiful music, in comparison to what?
I think it's also a kind of a reaction, and this is the contrast, uh-huh. to the serialism which had held such intellectual and academic... was in the intellectual and academic forefront for so long.
Serialism,
yes. The music of Arnold Schoenberg and the 12-note technique, which became more and more rarefied, mm-hmm. and which really held forth for a long time, particularly in academic circles. I think without the academic involvement in an interest in this kind of music, it probably would have died a much earlier death than in fact it has. Mm-hmm. You'll probably get a lot of angry response to that statement, because I think there are a lot of people in the academic world who have a vested interest in keeping it alive, because it's so interesting to look at and it's so interesting to talk about, mm-hmm. so interesting to write articles about. Problem is, it just doesn't sound very good.
Let me ask you this, following what you've just said at Applebaum about the academics and music history. Is this a private preserve? Do the academic musicians look upon classical music as some sort of a private preserve? How do they figure? How do they connect with ideas, discussions about the canon and what the canon consists of?
It's a really difficult question, because I consider myself both, I'm an academic wanting to get out of academe in terms of where my music is performed. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of talking to ourselves in terms of where our concerts occur and things of that nature. And upon entering the world, the real musical world outside, mm-hmm. where concert goers who've gone for several centuries, and maybe that's a bit too long, but where you encounter people who are outside of academe, who are there because they want to hear music.
Well, what is this middle ground? Tell me where the two meet. How would you characterize that? You sound like a bit of a populist here when you're describing your own goals as a musician. You don't want classical music to be a precious little enterprise enjoyed by just a few. Is that right?
Well, that's true, and I don't think it has been enjoyed by just a few.
Mm-hmm.
I am talking about the concert series where everyone goes to hear music. The problem is contemporary music per se has generally cloistered itself, at least in America, in the university atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
And now, with the changing of patronage, it's beginning to get outside of that cloister. And consequently, the music itself is changing. I'm not sure. It's a chicken and egg kind of distinction here. But on the other hand, it's real. It is occurring. There's a new program, I think it's about 3 years old, perhaps a little bit older, called Meet the Composer, which is sponsored by Exxon, Rockefeller, and the NEA. And I suppose there are other foundation support given to it also, in which composers are placed with major orchestras. And one of the functions of those composers with each orchestra is not only to have his or her music played by that orchestra, but to also select additional music for that orchestra to play. And fortunately, a piece of mine got selected several years ago by the St. Louis Symphony, and so therefore moving out of the area of academic performance into the wider area of symphonic, popular symphonic performance was a big step.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm by no means alone, because orchestras like, I don't want to exclude anybody, but St. Louis comes to mind. Even the Los Angeles Philharmonic has made a really concerted effort now to perform new and exciting music of our own time.
Ed, tell me how we touched on this briefly, but let's come back to it. How do you participate in the new romanticism? This is a little awkward. It's almost as though you've gone out and signed up to be a member of some sort of a cause or something. I'm sure it's far more complex than that. What does it mean to be a new romantic?
I can only speak for myself.
Uh-huh.
I have a very 19th century point of view about my music, and again, anyone who is in any creative or performing art is basically egotistical. I mean, it's a horrible assumption to make that somebody would be interested in what you have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, it's there. And that 19th century attitude that I have is that I would hope that somehow people experiencing my music would be changed by the experience.
Be specific for me.
I don't think I really can.
You're talking about an emotional response.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
And not that I create in order to manipulate responses, because that's a fairly easy thing to do. That's what television and movie music does very well.
Uh-huh.
But rather to just simply be as honest as I can in whatever it is I have to say,
mm-hmm.
and hopefully it will communicate to other people. Not direct thoughts or direct feelings of one kind or another, but rather whatever it is in the process of what I've said somehow communicates an emotion of the process. I'm not sure that's very clear.
Let me ask you to elaborate in this fashion, Ed Applebaum. When you set out to compose, whether it's a short, a part of a composition or an entire composition, are you looking for some sort of, I think T.S. Eliot used the word correlative. Are you looking for a kind of correspondence that you want to evoke in the audience?
I don't compose with an idea towards the audience reaction.
It's you. You're the focal point.
I'm the only audience I know.
Right.
And what I try to do is to just simply be as honest about what I'm feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty hard sometimes.
Do you work up to a position, quote unquote, that you are taking? That is to say, a mood that you are trying to convey, or do these things in the act of composition happen? Are they little flashing forths of what you feel? This honesty that you're expressing.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I always say, and I maintain, that I compose almost 100% from intuition. Mm-hmm. I don't really think about what it is I want to do.
It's a kind of an existential act, then.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And a very short way into whatever this piece is going to be, I find the piece writes itself.
Uh-huh.
And I find myself most in trouble when the piece doesn't begin to evolve and when I have to superimpose a conscious will over it.
Do you know that it's good or bad at the moment or after you've stepped back from it and listened to it? How does that work?
Well, I think those are really simultaneous occurrences. I think that, you know, putting the notes down is also, you know, we're talking about a duration of a few seconds.
Right.
I mean, something has occurred and it gets put down on paper. And then, you know, so you step back. But, I mean, I think you should have stepped back before you put it down on paper. On the other hand, erasers exist to the betterment of music. And I think they're perfectly legitimate compositional tools.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a conversation about classical and modern music. My guests are two music historians from the University of California at Santa Barbara, Edward Applebaum and William Prizer. Edward Applebaum is the winner of the 1984 Kennedy Center Friedheim Award for New American Music. His Friedheim Award-winning composition will be featured on next week's edition of Soundings. William Prizer recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming book about Italian Renaissance music, entitled Isabella d'Este and Music in Renaissance Mantua. Bill Prizer, you know this this man, Ed Applebaum, this composer, this professor of music. Do you think he listens to the critics? Generalize for me, if not necessarily in terms of Ed Applebaum, do composers, what kind of attention do they pay to the critical voices that they have to hear? Maybe that's not a fair question.
Oh, I think it's an interesting question, without a doubt. It seems to me that composers nowadays are paying more attention to critics than they have in the past. Milton Babbitt in 1958 wrote an article entitled "Who Cares If You Listen?"
Right. You told me before our conversation that this was enormously influential.
It was, in fact, and it had to do with the ivory tower attitude of composers and the serialist music that Ed has already talked about.
Right.
I don't know that composers still write for the critics by any means. In fact, I would be willing to say that they do not.
But in one fashion or another, they can't avoid them.
One can't avoid them.
Yeah.
One can certainly burn the clippings.
Now, Ed sort of shrugged at that. Do you avoid them? How much do you take them into account?
I frankly don't take them into account. In fact, I know quite a few composers who literally don't even read them.
Why? It's a dangerous thing?
I think they don't care.
I see.
I think it's important to remember that while critics are certain kinds of barometers, they don't make the decisions. The conductors and the performers make the decisions as to what's going to be heard.
Well, the larger question then becomes, do the audiences listen to the critics? What do you think of that?
I think that they tend to. And that can be both good and bad, you know, depending on the critic. I mean, there are some absolutely wonderful critics with insight, and there are some who really shouldn't be criticizing. A friend of mine, Martin Bernheimer, who's the critic from the LA Times, assures me that composers tend to grade critics as to how they like their music.
Sure.
I sure agree with that.
Bill Prizer?
I think it's important to realize that a music critic, acting in his function of reviewing a concert, is not performing the same kind of job that a critic of a movie or a critic of a novel will be performing. We're not talking about, with a new work being done by a symphony orchestra, a long series of performances that are going to be done by that orchestra, and the critic is therefore not going to have that much immediate to say about whether people are going to go to the concert as they would go to a movie, or whether they will buy tickets to the concert as they would buy a copy of a new novel. It's his job really seems to me to be more in vacuo in that instance. Now, a critic of a record would be a different matter.
Uh-huh.
That would be more analogous.
Because there you have more or less a text available to both the critic and the audience. Whereas in the other instance, you're talking about a performance. Ed Applebaum?
Yeah, I think that to follow up with what Bill just said is that the music critic is more in the area of cultural reporting, cultural analysis.
Uh-huh.
And what he or she does is set a kind of a mood for what's coming next.
Uh-huh.
And so in certain areas where critics have been entirely hostile to new music, either the antagonism continues between audience and performers, or the conductor goes, or the critic goes, but it can't remain that way. And you find fewer and fewer critics who are contemporary music antagonistic. They have become a great deal more educated and sympathetic. The music has changed. That's the really important part, is the music today is different than it was 10 or 15 years ago. And it makes it a lot easier for everyone concerned.
Give me some particulars. Tell me about some transitions. Tell me about some nows and some thens in this change as recent as 10 years.
Well, I think we've already touched on it. I think the thens, that's a hard one, dealt with a kind of very uncompromising attitude about what music should be. It was more pre-compositional.
More theoretical?
Yeah, I think so. Uh-huh. Somehow the ideas were so engendered in the process of writing the music and the beautiful formulae that existed that the connection between that formula and that perceiver, that audience, was almost non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for a long time we used to sit in either classrooms, I remember being a student, having this feeling, and in concert halls, and somehow feeling that if I didn't appreciate or enjoy this piece, there was something wrong with me.
Uh-huh.
And now I just simply refuse to accept that. I simply say, I don't like that piece, and also I don't think it sounds very good.
Mm-hmm.
It's still personal on my point, from my perspective, but I reserve the right to say I don't think that music sounds very good.
And you're not being merely idiosyncratic in that. Do you think that's typical or representative?
I think it's less typical of people really willing to say it.
Uh-huh.
But I think I think history will probably say that it was true.
Uh-huh.
I mean, for whatever reason. I mean, I'm sure that historians will soon come up with a lexicon of terminology to deal with it in a polite way. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it has happened. So what's happened to change it is that the music has changed. It was there all the time. I have a favorite theory about and I think it's historically has occurred before, but with Mahler and with the kind of intense personal probing that man did, I mean, the music seemed to come right out of the air and right into your guts and wrench them and pull them apart. I think that music got to a point, as did a lot of other things in the early teens of this century, where people had to stand back. That to go forward was so intensely overwhelming and dramatic and soul-searching that somehow it was just overwhelming. I think we were overloaded. And yet, with that stepping back, in various areas, and I think mostly in nationalistic composers, there was a retention of certain qualities that Mahler had,
mm-hmm.
and which continued sort of uninfluenced by the modernity of other kinds of music. And then I think sort of at the end of the 50s, in the early part of the 60s, we had two or three fabulously great composers who went through all these processes of writing the intense serial compositions.
And who are they?
The names that come to mind first are primarily Luciano Berio, Ligeti, and Ludoslavsky, three great European composers who began writing, again, different kinds of music, again, softer kinds of music. And it became something that people in general, audiences as human beings who go, after all, to concerts to be enlightened in one way or another, mm-hmm. Started gravitating towards. And that gravitation sort of began to encourage other people to perform this same music. And mm-hmm. then other composers, young students coming through the academic mill, began to have more courage about writing kinds of music which was less structured, less pre-compositional, mm-hmm. more honest. Let's use American nationalism, because American nationalism in music is jazz.
Mm-hmm. You're not talking now about patriotism.
Not at all. Right. That's irrelevant sure. to this. I spoke with several students who had worked with Nadia Boulanger, the great French teacher of so many American composers. Mm-hmm. And particularly I remember a conversation with Roy Harris in which he said that Boulanger said to him, now this is fourth hand already, sure. but she said, the important thing about your music is what is your own, not what is France's, not what is Russia or whatever, but what is your own? What's your own cultural heritage? An American's cultural heritage is the stuff that they were playing in New Orleans,
yep.
et cetera, et cetera, and came up through Chicago to Harlem and, you know, became jazz. And it's very sophisticated kinds of stuff, but it really is our heritage. Now, the composers I know today who are, you know, sort of my age, the 35 to 50-year-old generation, we're all jazz players. We all played jazz.
You
and
too?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's where we grew up. That was our first experience with music. And I don't think we should ever forget that experience. Not to carry a banner about it, but it's the thing that I was talking about earlier in terms of my own music, is that is my own. Mm-hmm. My own is not Stravinsky. My own is not Schoenberg. And my own is not even Bartok.
Well, who
my own is yeah, well, Dave Brubeck and right. Stan Kenton, uh-huh. Jerry Mulligan, Oscar Peterson, uh-huh. Chick Corea. That's my own. Those are my people.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about classical and modern music. My guests were Edward Applebaum and William Prizer of the University of California at Santa Barbara. Edward Applebaum is the winner of the 1984 Kennedy Center Friedheim Award for New American Music. His Friedheim Award-winning composition, Symphony No. 2, will be featured on next week's edition of Soundings. William Prizer recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming book about Italian Renaissance music, entitled Isabella d'Este and Music in Renaissance Mantua. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Classical and Modern Music, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for a discussion about classical music in the 1980s. My guests will be two scholars from the University of California at Santa Barbara, Edward Applebaum and William Prizer. Edward Applebaum is the 1984 winner of the Kennedy Center Friedheim Award for New American Music. What's the status of classical music? If there is a canon of classical music today, where does it come from, and who determines its contemporary outlines? Music and the Tradition. Listen for some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station,